Dr. Dave here. Our cat is named Kaat. That's K-A-A-T. Very creative, eh? Well, you can get creative and save yourself some money on your pet's medications by taking advantage of our special discount. Your pet's same medications and prescriptions will be delivered to your door, saving you time and money. Just click on the Pet Meds logo on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com, follow the links, and you will automatically save 10% plus get free shipping on orders over $39.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 211, Resurrection After Rape, with Matt Atkinson. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
One of the things that makes rape work so difficult for the survivor is that the rape itself does have meaning. It symbolizes something. It's not just an experience of pain. It's a symbolic wound also. And I talk in the book about the three wounds that are brought on by rape. And obviously the first one is physical. The second one is the social wound, you know, the scorn, the humiliation, the blaming, the well-meaning people who say, aren't you over it yet? It's been 3 months or it's been 3 years. Shouldn't you be over it? You should just make up your mind to be over it. Just let it go. Being mistreated in legal systems. But the third wound, which I think is the most significant one, is the internal one, like the existential wound, the feeling of being disconnected from life, being alienated, being uniquely different, uniquely cast off from others.
That was the voice of my guest, Matt Atkinson. Matt Atkinson, LCSW, is a licensed clinical social worker and therapist who works with trauma survivors. He's also author of the book, Resurrection After Rape, A Guide to Transforming from Victim to Survivor. He's worked in crisis services as a staff director with the YWCA in prevention of domestic and sexual violence, where he's developed and implemented programs with women's prisons, university sports teams, churches, and Indian tribes. In 2004, he became the first male given the National Award for Outstanding Advocacy and Community Work in Ending Sexual Violence by the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. In 2005, he was awarded Most Therapeutic by his professional peers at St. Anthony Hospital. In 2006, he began to teach college courses on domestic violence and crisis intervention as an adjunct professor at Oklahoma State University. He also regularly presents trainings at workshops and conferences. In 2009, Matt will begin a series of all-day training workshops for therapists, funded through grants and organized by the Oklahoma Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The methods presented in Resurrection After Rape will be the default treatment approach taught to crisis workers and therapists as part of their crisis service certification process. Matt has degrees in art and human physiology, behavioral science, and a master's in clinical social work from Oklahoma University. He's married and has two sons, and is an Ojibwe pipekeeper and regularly participates in ceremonies. Now, here's the interview. Matt Atkinson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm sure glad to be here and be part of this.
Well, I heard about your work from one of my listeners, and after taking a look at your website, I thought you'd make a great guest for the show.
Thank you.
So tell us a bit about your personal and educational background and how you got into the work that you're doing today.
Well, this is it's not work that I actually set out to do. If you'd asked me at one time what I want to do, I never would have expected that I would become a specialist in treating sexual trauma. In fact, I got my start here in Oklahoma as a social worker, working with Indian tribes, doing youth programs and cultural preservation programs, things like that. And
well, let me back you up just a little bit further and tell us about even how you, you know, what you majored in as an undergraduate and how you got drawn into social work.
Okay. I started off as an art and human physiology major because I was going to go into medical illustration.
Interesting.
But sociology and psychology classes got my attention, and it diverted my life into something that I really love. And I wanted to begin to do work with psychology and social work and counseling. So I went back and got additional degrees in behavioral science and got my master's in social work and my clinical license, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
And you've written a book on recovering from rape. And I gather working with rape victims has become a specialty for you. I think it's somewhat surprising to see a man devoted to this work. I would think women who've been raped might have difficulty trusting a man. Has this been an issue? And if so, how have you handled it?
That's a great question. It's been a surprise for a lot of people. When I do public speaking or go to classes, I'm not usually the person that people expect to see coming in the door. And what your listeners don't know is not only am I a man, but I'm a really big guy. I'm 6.5 feet tall. I'm native, so I have, you know, very long hair and wear a lot of the traditional accessories that go along with that. And, you know, for a lot of women, their first test of courage is the day that they meet me and they're introduced to me as their counselor. And they think, you've got to be kidding. Surely they said Mary. They didn't say Matt. They said Mary, right? and that's been a test for a lot of people. And
wow, I can imagine.
A lot of my patients, when they're finished with work, they confess something to me. They say, you know, Matt, the very first day when I met you, I thought, I'm not telling this man anything.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to talk to this guy. And I've had to understand that and be very gentle and very patient and watch my body language because of it. But there's been some interesting research on men who do work with rape trauma victims. And there was one study, it's found in the book Rape Work, by Dr. Kathy Doherty. And she talks about looking at outcome evaluations with women who had come through rape trauma counseling and what were their experiences when they had male counselors. And she confesses having a little bias that she expected to see women really resistant to working with a male. And she says, you know, what I found was actually the opposite. A lot of times the women with a male counselor had some of the higher outcome satisfaction results. And what the research is finding is that men can actually be very competent at doing good rape work, but there are some common mistakes that we men make that are cautioned in the literature. And if we're aware of those, then we can actually do some pretty good work. And a lot of the women that have worked with me have come through 3-4 previous therapists, and a lot of therapists have referred some of their clients to me when the treatment just gets stuck or when it stalls out. And they say, you know, I want you to go and talk to Matt and just give him a chance.
Well, that's really fascinating background info, and it certainly is a testament to you that they do relax and learn to trust you. How would you describe your approach?
Well, I like an eclectic approach. You know, like a lot of people, we get raised with, we get educated with a background that cognitive behavioral therapy becomes the default technique. What I've found is actually expanding on that seems to do a lot better job. I like to use a really creative approach, and I'm a firm believer in what a lot of research has shown, that of all of the things that promote a client's successful outcome, method is actually third on the list. The first two are the client's expectation or hope of success, and the second is the nature of the client and counselor bond.
That's right. I've read that too.
So I really believe that, and there are times even that I will confess that I depart from a lot of academic school methodology, and there's times that I have to set textbooks and methods and worksheets aside. And what matters in certain critical moments working with a rape survivor is the person that you bring to the process with them. And they can sense that.
Amen. I really like what you're saying. Makes sense to me.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Can I tell you a story about one of those?
Yes, please do.
I had a client, a woman named Danae, a really remarkable client of mine. And Danae's story is presented in the book that I wrote. So she's come forward and foregone confidentiality to share her story very publicly. And like a lot of people going through this process, rape recovery is an extraordinarily painful process. It's the hardest thing that she will ever do, and it's so worth it. There was one time that she hit a real crisis in her recovery. And like a lot of people do, she took a step back, and she spent a weekend just demolishing herself, going back into old self-destructive behaviors and just feeling very ashamed of herself again. She thought that she had failed womankind, failed other survivors, failed me. And she came in to counseling ready to confess and accept that I was going to terminate and reject her and abandon her and scold her. So she kind of shuffled in, just head hung down like a beat dog, just feeling horrible. And I got to tell you, at that moment, if I had come at her like a social worker or like a therapist and typical methods, it would have been all wrong. And at that moment, seeing her at her lowest point, I had to step outside of some of those traditional methods. And I just said to her, before she said a word, I said, "Danae, you look like a woman who needs a hug." And she just fell forward, grabbed me, and just sobbed. Sobbed.
Yes.
And this would raise some eyebrows among colleagues. Well, what about hugs? And what about this? And why didn't you process such and such? But that would have been all wrong in that moment. And because I'm a big guy, I am really conservative about those things. I just do not touch my patients. I'm so cautious about that. But there are times when the person you bring into the process is more important than insight and background and degrees. And what she needed was just to know that she still had a connection to a life, a human being that believed in her. And that, more than any technique, was what mattered. So when I say an eclectic technique, that includes even just the human-to-human connection that I think is needed in this work.
Well, that's a great story, and it does really illustrate your point, and feel free to throw in any other stories that come to mind. I like the way your book is organized around the sorts of questions that a rape victim might typically ask. Maybe we could go through some of those. Would that be okay?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Well, one question you pose is therapy necessary for recovery from rape? What's your answer to that?
Well, I'm a little bit strong. I kind of lean towards the opinion that therapy is just about an indispensable resource. I do think that it's possible for some people to recover without it. And I wrote to some colleagues. I wrote to a doctor who had also written a book on rape trauma and asked her opinion. And the consensus was, it's not so much what you name the resource you use to recover, whether you call it therapy or call it something else. It's more a matter of whether you have some resource that encourages you to come out of hiding, to disclose the full details of your trauma, and to assist you in reprocessing some of the faulty beliefs and the traumatic symptoms of the trauma. But I did find a lot of interesting research on rape and post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's really troubling to consider a person trying to recover on their own when you look at what some of the research says about the symptoms of this. One study found that 94% of rape victims will meet the criteria for PTSD just almost immediately. And what you find with that is that 1 in 3 rape victims attempt suicide each year during the first 3 years following rape. That's an extraordinarily high rate of suicide attempts. You find that over the first 3 years following rape, the PTSD levels do drop a bit. They drop to about half, but then you don't see any further improvement without therapeutic resource. They settle there. So about half of rape victims continue to have persistent PTSD, and it just continues. And this trauma doesn't go away by waiting it out or ignoring it or hiding from it or fleeing it with alcohol, with sex, with self-injury. It persists. When you add in good therapeutic resources for the victim, you see a remarkable transformation. You see a lot of the symptoms of PTSD becoming resolved. But going to therapy is so terrifying for somebody. They think it's going to be the most, you know, a more painful experience. And what we're actually seeing is that a lot of the PTSD symptoms do get resolved with good, competent rape trauma therapy.
Well, that's good to know. And who knows, there might be some listeners who could benefit from hearing this. Another question that you speak to are triggers. The question is, what are triggers and what should I do about them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's something that I've heard a lot about. Triggers are, they're the things that the brain recognizes and associates with the original trauma. And when it associates those with trauma, it kicks the sympathetic nervous system into like a really defensive mode of operation. And I talk in the book in very basic language, because I don't want it to be a scholarly textbook that bores readers who may not be interested in the academics of things. But I talk briefly about a part of the brain called the amygdala that really controls a lot of these traumatic responses. And the amygdala screens the environment and incoming sensory input for anything it recognizes that it connects with the original trauma. And if it gets a hit, if it gets a match, then it fires off a warning signal to the nervous system that takes over the body, and it brings on panic attacks or fight or flight, temper, adrenaline surges, things like that. And it's part of our basic human survival biology. And I say in the book that, you know, that works really well in prehistory out in the plains dealing with wild animals, not so great in the aisles of Walmart.
Right. You know, I think when I think of triggers, I'm thinking in case of returning war vets, that hearing a firecracker or a car backfiring might trigger some kind of flashback or panic. In the case of a rape victim, what sorts of things would serve as triggers?
Oh, I've got some amazing stories about some powerful triggers with some of the women I've worked with. Times of year, anniversary times, seem to be a big trigger. And I'm noticing among a support group that I participate in that spring, May and June especially, I don't know why, but seem to be really prominent triggers. There seems to be a lot of women in my groups who have trauma relating to those months, but could be any time of year. Scent, of course, is probably most strongly linked to memory and trauma. Some women can't listen to certain songs because they were in the background during rape. I had a client one time who was raped while the movie Toy Story was playing. And the phrase, and this is really unfortunate, but the phrase "to infinity and beyond" became her trigger. What was interesting about her is that she successfully recovered. She beat her trauma symptoms doing some incredible work and actually reclaimed that phrase. And when she was finished, she got a tattoo of that phrase on her arm, because now, rather than it representing a trigger, it represented her potential, her power being returned. But songs, times of year, even certain touch. I get a lot of emails and calls and requests from women whose sex lives with their husbands have been affected, because during sex they may be triggered. And a lot of men even write to me and say, "Look, man, I just got to ask you, just guy to guy, man, what do I do about this? How do I help my wife, or how do I help my girlfriend? Because this is happening. It's affecting our marriage."
Oh, yeah. I imagine that's a huge issue. Another thing that you say in the book is that victims should challenge their old beliefs about rape. What sorts of beliefs or myths about rape need to be challenged, and how does one go about doing that?
One of the things that sets a lot of my therapy apart from some other traditional therapies is, in the past, there's been the idea that if we can get someone in counseling to tell their story, to open up the details of their story, then they can, quote, get it out. And I don't think that's the final step in the process. I do think that that's a necessary step. But I think part two of that is then repairing the beliefs and the myths and the ideas and even the self-shaming thoughts that the person has carried as a result of the story. We call those stuck points, and my patients hate the stuck point work. It's their least favorite part because it means identifying the most painful, the most embarrassing, the most gruesome parts of their story and evaluating them for what they think those parts of the story prove about them. So the way I describe it is that a stuck point is the gap in your thinking between what you used to believe and what you believe now because of the rape, or what you wanted to believe and what the rape seems to prove instead. So some examples of common stuck points or common self-blaming beliefs that I see in the women I work with are things like, I put myself in that position. Or if my body froze in panic, then that means that I was weak. I allowed it. It's my fault because I should have fought and kicked and screamed, but instead my body was locked up in paralysis at the time. Or I should have known. I should have seen signs in this guy. How could I have not recognized it that this was a violent guy? So a lot of those kind of self-blaming beliefs. What if I was drinking? What if I was at a party? I had one woman who was just viciously gang raped at a college party. And her stuck point was that when she was a college student, her volunteer work on the campus was actually working in the Women's Services Center doing rape education. So in her mind, it was, if anyone should have known, it would have been me. If anyone would have been, invulnerable to this, it should have been me, and yet this happened. So I must just be at fault. It's my fault. So I see a lot of that kind of thinking in the people that I work with.
Maybe that's what you're getting at when you have a section on the meaning of the rape. And, my initial reaction on reading that was, well, meaning, how can there be meaning in rape? But maybe what you're getting at is that sort of core message that they code it in using it against themselves.
Yeah. That's one of the things that makes rape work so difficult for the survivor is that the rape itself does have meaning. It symbolizes something. It's not just an experience of pain. It's a symbolic wound also. And I talk in the book about the three wounds that are brought on by rape. And obviously the first one is physical. The second one is the social wound, the scorn, the humiliation, the blaming, the well-meaning people who say, aren't you over it yet? It's been 3 months or it's been 3 years. Shouldn't you be over it? You should just make up your mind to be over it. Just let it go. Being mistreated in legal systems. But the third wound, which I think is the most significant one, is the internal one, like the existential wound, the feeling of being disconnected from life, being alienated, being uniquely different, uniquely cast off from others. And so I do see that, and that's why I talk about what the rape means, that we give meaning to our pain. Now, can I give you just an example of how we do that?
Yes.
I'm thinking this is just an example. Hypothetically, theoretically, let's say that tomorrow two women will each go to a doctor's appointment. One of them will be going to the dentist, and she will experience pain as she hears the dental drill and has a root canal. The other one will be going to give birth, and she will experience pain also. And even though there are two women both going through pain tomorrow, because of the meaning of the pain, the experience will mean something different to each one of them. One is something that's terrifying and unpleasant and that she wants to avoid, and the other brings with it great blessing and great joy. So we give our pain meaning, and that helps us survive, but it also means that when our pain is traumatic, then it devastates us to our core. Rape is not just a physical and psychological wound, it's a soul wound. It's deeply, I would say deeply spiritual. I don't mean to sound corny, but it's something that affects a person's body, mind, and soul because it has meaning. So that's why I talk about what the rape means to the person I'm working with.
Yes. Well, you have the woman write out a very detailed account of her rape story. What happens when they do that, and what's the underlying reason for that assignment?
Well, the rationale for it, the basis for it, is that we want the brain to alter how it responds to the trauma itself. Because when the amygdala is doing all the heavy lifting, when it's got the whole burden of trying to handle this trauma, then it gets it wrong sometimes. It fires triggers that aren't really triggers. Panic attacks come when they're not necessary, when nobody wants to feel them. By writing down the details, the narrative of what's happened, we engage other parts of the brain in managing the symptoms. And that allows the brain eventually to begin to rest. It can slow down and calm and contemplate the content of the trauma. And actually, you see the symptoms of the trauma begin to subside. But writing it down in detail is the most terrifying moment in all of this work.
Does it sometimes bring up negative emotional reactions?
Not only does it, but sometimes the emotions are more intense writing it than they were during the rape itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a time where a good therapist takes very, very great care with the person they're working with. Like, I never do this at the beginning. You're never going to see me in the second session saying, okay, I want you to write this. We do this near the end. We do it on the client's schedule when she knows that she's ready so that there's no fear. She's in control at every step.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrifying. I had one woman whose story was 19 pages long. Most of the stories that women write are 5 or 6 pages. Hers was 19, and she would write a paragraph and go throw up.
Wow.
She'd come back and write and go throw up. And she said, the next day, no sleep, tears running down her face. She said, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And after she was done with it, she said, I'm so glad I did it. It's the worst thing I've ever done, and it's the best thing I've ever done. She said, it changed my life to do that.
Mm.
And at first, she said, I was so mad at you. Why is Matt making me do this? Doesn't he see how much this hurts me? And then she said, I can't believe the change in me. I can't believe the difference from having done that.
Wow. Why, that's got to be so gratifying.
It's amazing. And people ask me all the time, Matt, how can you do this? Doesn't it depress you? How can you do this every day? I've worked with more than 500 women in counseling for rape trauma.
Wow.
And they say, don't you get tired of listening to people's problems? And I say, I'm not listening to problems. I'm listening for solutions. And I don't see despair every day. I see revival. I see resurrection. I see empowerment every day. And to me, it's the most amazing process to be part of.
Yes. Well, speaking of empowerment, later on you talk about using their story as a weapon. How so?
Yeah, that's a tough point to make, but it's I challenge some of the people I work with not to use their story as a weapon. And what I mean by that is that a person's rape story has the potential to shock, to astonish others. And it's very tempting, and I'm going to say this as gently as I can, because it's a delicate point to make. It's very tempting to find a secondary use of a story in being able to avoid a lot of painful experiences in life. Like, I've seen some people who will compete with one another for whose story is worse.
Mm.
And it's a tragic experience, but I have seen that happen. Or people who shield themselves from a lot of parts of life by saying, well, that's not available to me. That part of life, that's not meant for me because I was raped. Or I can't do this work. You don't understand how painful this is because I was raped. Now, I got to tell you, I'm a tough therapist. Now, I'm gentle and I'm loving and I'm warm. I'm creative, but I'm tough. And I don't let the people I work with use the pain of rape trauma to minimize the difficulty of this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them there are no longer victims in the groups that I run or in the counseling that I do. That this is something that you have the power to do, and it's going to be difficult, but we're going to get through it. And I don't let people fend off the obligations and the requirements of good therapy by saying things like, "Don't you see how much this hurts? You know, let me remain delicate." Let me be uniquely wounded so that you ask less of me. I think that part of recovery to becoming a survivor rather than a victim means reclaiming a lot of that power. And that's what I want to promote. And a lot of my patients get frustrated with me. They coined a phrase that's kind of funny. It's been handed down for 2 years. They call it "Damn you, Matt."
Damn you, Matt.
Yeah, they call it the "Damn you, Matt" moments, and they've even abbreviated it to DYM. Like, oh God, here comes my DYM. And I've even begun to use it too. I'll ask them. I say, "You ready for your DYM of the day?" Yeah, just get it over with. Come on, because a lot of times the beliefs and the stuck points have to be challenged. They have to be nudged forward into new thinking. And that's why I talk about not using your story to protect the status quo of how you function and how you feel and how you live.
You've mentioned group work a couple of times. Do you find that meeting with rape victims in a group is particularly effective?
Absolutely. Knowing what I know now, I don't know that I would try it any other way. I think you can succeed in individual work, but group work is so healthy for a survivor. And I don't do groups of entirely rape victims. I may have 8 people in a group, and 3 may be dealing with rape, and we may have 1 returning soldier, and 1 new father, and 1 domestic violence victim, and all together. And I've seen that is so healthy, because, like I mentioned, the third wound of rape is feeling disconnected from life, feeling uniquely alone, a unique misfit. And when a victim can hear understanding and can hear similar experiences shared by other people, it's reassuring. And I mentioned that a lot of them will come in very resistant. They don't want to talk to me. They don't want to be there. And I told you about Danae. Danae benefited from group work because she was able to hide for 2 weeks in the group. And when she started, she held a blanket up over her face, pulled her hoodie tight around her face, but just curled up in a chair, didn't want to talk, scared to death. And what she was doing was auditioning me. She was listening to see how I would treat the other women. And you know what she was waiting for? She was waiting for victim blaming. She was waiting for the moment when I would advise somebody else who'd been raped, well, let's talk about how to not put yourself in that position again. And if I'd have said that, she'd have been out the door. Mm. And for 2 weeks, she heard no victim blaming. She saw compassion. She noticed that I do not treat rape victims as broken people. I do not see them as broken. Even when they see themselves that way, I don't. And gradually, it helped her to come out of her shell, and she could share within the group. So I see group work being remarkably powerful. There's one other reason why I use group work, and I want to share this story with you, too.
Okay. Yeah.
For a lot of women, when they think back to their rape, and when they think to the images of it, they think to very brutal images. They think to the time that they were curled up in the bathroom, or they were hurt, or they were stunned, they were battered, they were physically injured. In a group, the day that they finally read and tell their story, with all of the terror and all of the fear that means, they are able to form a new memory. And I have the group remain silent when someone tells their story. And then I process with the person afterward, and I ask them to literally look face to face around the circle and describe in their own words what they perceive on the face of their peers. And it's the most incredible moment, because they will begin to have this look of awe on their face, and they'll say, "My God, she loves me right now. He believes my story. She is feeling respected that I shared it with her. She thinks I'm strong." And they'll look face to face, and they'll begin to discern that.
Yes.
And then I deliberately, I put this in words, I make them focus on this, that what you've just seen in this circle, the looks back to you, the support, the love, the belief, this now is the new final memory of your story, not the girl crying on the bathroom floor.
Nice.
When you think back to your story now, this is the memory of how this ends, and look at what you have in this room. And it's a transformative experience.
Yes, I love the way you framed that. A question that you address is whether or not a woman should confront a rapist. What are some of the issues around that?
Safety is number one. I try to be so careful to think about the safety of the people I work with. And I looked at some of the research on confronting, and most of the research is actually about confronting childhood sexual abusers. There's not a lot written about confronting like adolescent or adult rape perpetrators. What I found is that the literature says And this isn't real helpful. It's kind of ambivalent. It says for some people it's the exact right thing to do. For some it's the exact wrong thing to do. What I look at are the reasons why a person wants to confront. And I want to know if they're just feeling so powerful at the moment, so gung-ho, that they may not be considering safety issues. Because ironically, a lot of people, when they come through this, they overestimate their power. They already take on the world. You know, it's what I call, they want to be Xena, the warrior princess now, and they're going to just take on anybody. And so I have to slow it down and say, you know, hold on, wait, let's think about safety. Let's consider this. So I want to look with them at the reasons for it, the method of confrontation, any legal issues that are going on, things like that. And I've had some people choose to confront. Almost always they've chosen to confront by letter rather than in person, which I think is a bit safer. So yes. I have had some do that.
Yes.
And they do that on their own. I never put them up to it. I never suggest or advise it at all. It needs to entirely be their choice. They need to lead every step in that. Danae confronted her childhood perpetrator by letter. And was well served by it. Actually, she gained a lot in her mental health and her emotional recovery by being able to do that. And even said, you know, my fear is gone. It's like he was a boogeyman that haunted the horizon of my world, and now I've reclaimed that.
That's great. I love the way that you consult the literature regularly. I'm not sure that all therapists do that, but that's the interplay that should exist between the science and the art of therapy, I think.
I try to, you know, if anyone raises their eyebrow and say, you know, Matt, you use some unconventional methods. You know, that's true. My friends tell me I'm the Patch Adams of social work. it may be unusual and creative at times, but I can go back and show, well, here's the rationale. I'm not just being a maverick. I didn't just make stuff up because it seems cool. There's a reason for doing this. And when I do have to come up with something new, I try to follow the principles of our profession that we consult with colleagues and we get their insight. We consider the client's safety and we let the client collaborate and even direct a lot of this process for their own purpose.
Yes. You know, an intriguing and I think rather delicate question you raise is, what if my body had a sexual response during the rape?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess there'd be tremendous guilt around that. Is that, in fact, something that happens, and how do you deal with that?
It does, and talk about an incredibly strong stuck point. It's something that's really taboo, and I'm going to tell you, there's not that I've even been able to find in literature about this. It seems to be something that we don't talk about, even in the profession. But what we're talking about, to be blunt, is what about the person who orgasms during a rape? And you can just imagine the incredible level of trust it's taken for women to bring this up and talk to me about it.
Yes.
You know, being a guy, first of all, but just the deep shame that they feel because of it. And they think that it proves something wicked about themselves. Like I have a woman that I talk to a lot, who's, you know, very spiritual, very devout, religious Christian woman. And it took a long time for her to divulge that this was her experience when she was a very young child, and she didn't understand it. And for a long time, she thought it meant she was wicked. And that meant that as an adult, even though she had a wonderful marriage to a great guy, she withheld herself from sexual pleasure because she thought, if I enjoy my body physically, it makes me as sick as my rapist. And dealing with that belief is so—it's so delicate. It really takes a gentle and very patient approach. And at that point, we as therapists have to be able to talk in a very classy way, but in a very direct way about how our bodies work, about the nerves of the body and how they function. We have to, you know, even me as a guy, I have to be able to talk comfortably about the female anatomy and how it's built and why it triggers in this way. And I give an image in the book, and I actually borrowed this from a colleague, but I give an image in the book of cutting an onion. How does our body respond when that happens? And you know, my patients will say, well, we cry. And I say, well, what is it about cutting an onion that makes us so sad? And she says, well, we don't feel sad. It's just how our body reacts. And then they get it. Oh.
That's a great, great metaphor.
And another one I share is like, I hate being tickled, but when you tickle me, I bust out in laughter. Now, does that mean that I really like it? Does that mean I'm colluding with the person who's doing it? Absolutely not. It means that nerves, they don't think, they don't reason, they don't contemplate, they just fire. And they send the one message that they're programmed to send when they're triggered a certain way. It has nothing to do with being immoral or being wicked or somehow overlapping the mindset of your rapist or your perpetrator. It simply means that your body is anatomically functioning the way it was built. It has nothing to do with any other part of the trauma or with your mindset or anything like that. But women see that as an indictment of themselves, and so they don't want to talk about what if their body responded a certain way. And I got so much feedback over that chapter from women writing to me saying, thank God you wrote that. I've struggled with that for 20 years.
Wow.
No one's ever talked about that. So I was nervous putting it in because I didn't want to, you know, trigger people. And
yeah.
It turns out that a lot of people were really dealing with this in secret.
That's fascinating. I majored in creative writing at one point. That's what I ended up majoring in college. And uh-huh. My creative writing teacher had actually a published novel, and his novel was about a rape. And some of these elements were in that novel. Now, how he knew this stuff, I don't know. I remember at the time, you know, I was like 18, 19, 20. To me, some of what he was saying was far-fetched. And one of the elements in the novel is something that you talk about, which is that in the novel, the woman became fairly promiscuous after the rape. And that's something that you write about. How often does that happen and why?
That's another thing that is just missing in a lot of the literature, which is a shame because it's far more common than we think. I've seen a link between sexual trauma and sexually compulsive and sexually destructive behaviors afterward. And it's something that is just not talked about. See, when I first started this work, you know, I was just a young guy, just a little punk kid, and I didn't know much about all this. I would have thought, because I didn't know much more than just, you know, rape myth, I would have thought that if someone had come through rape, the last thing that they would want was any kind of sexual touch or any experience. And that is true in some cases, absolutely. But then I found the other side. I found that there were people who were very sexually compulsive, very sexually risk-taking. And I had to begin to explore that with them. And I came up with a new theory, a term that I coined. I put it in the book. Instead of the term promiscuous now, I talk to my clients about sexualized grieving. And it kind of baffles them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, you know, when someone's been hurt, people grieve with alcohol. Oh, yeah, yeah, we get that. People grieve with drugs. Yeah, they understand that, too.
Interesting.
And then I say, but did you know people can grieve with sex? And it astonishes them. Because a lot of women, when they really begin to trust me and they begin to open up to me, they confess a sexually troubled background. And I'm going to use some rough language here, but this is their words. They say, I'm nothing but a slut. I'm just a whore. Look at what I've done.
Yeah.
And I try to reframe that and say, you know, look, all actions represent needs that are trying to be met. And you didn't do this because you're wicked. You did this because you were in pain. This was your pain being expressed in behavior. And when they can understand this as a pain behavior and not as an immoral or sick behavior, then it extinguishes some of the shame and they can begin to deal with it. Like, why was I doing that? What was I doing? What was I seeking with that? And they can then talk about it in a more open way.
Yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that. What about sex becoming enjoyable again? How many of the people that you work with are able to get over the trauma to the degree to where they can enjoy sex?
I see that sexual enjoyment is one of the big stumbling blocks. It's something that's hardest to work on because a lot of times what I found is that women, especially who've been raped or been through sexual abuse, learn to disconnect their minds from their bodies during
yep.
the sexual experiences.
Yep.
They dissociate. They go numb. They float, so to speak, and they don't exist within their bodies during that. So reconnecting themselves to their body's experiences during sex is a really tough process. It is possible. And there are some really good resources that help with that. One of my favorites is a book called The Sexual Healing Journey by a woman named Wendy Maltz, M-A-L-T-Z. I love her book. It should be on any therapist's shelf because it's written for survivors of trauma. And I talk about it in my book, too. Like, do I have to be numb or do I have to be drunk to enjoy sex again? And what I found is that people who dissociate, you know, they blank out or they disconnect their mind from their bodies, have a hard time being introspective. They have a hard time sitting with their emotions during intense experiences, and sex is a really intense experience. So it's really hard to stay present and feel with your own body what you're going through. So I don't think that rape is a sexual experience, but I do think it has sexual effects, sexual consequences. And a lot of times when someone's rape or sexual abuse is an early life experience, it conditions them to think that sex is about power and about control. And they think that sex is a transaction of power. And we talk in my book about journaling on what sex is, you know, what kind of terms to use. And they, you know, people use terms like getting some, hitting it, kicking it, nailing her, things like that. And they're aggressive words. They're power words. And so a lot of people who've been through this think that sex is something that you give up from you to your partner for your partner's advantage. It's not something that a person enjoys for themselves. So we talk about redefining sex apart from rape, you know, drawing a line between them, that sex and rape are very different. And having sexual feelings is not a guilty thing.
You know, that's one place where I think Freud really hit the nail on the head. People like to dismiss Freud, but to me, he early on makes sense of this strange and paradoxical seeming connection between sex and aggression.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think so. And, you know, and I think, you know, we talk also about, like, with Jung, that people are not all good or all bad, that we have our positive attributes, but we have a dark side, too.
Yes.
And when you've been traumatized, I think there's a fear that sex becomes the open door to the dark side, and it doesn't have to be. It's if I enjoy sex, does that make me as sick as my abuser? You know, if my mind becomes preoccupied with something sexual, does that mean that I'm going down the path that my perpetrator went down? And it doesn't mean that, but it's a deeply entrenched fear, and unless we can talk about it honestly and give people permission to enjoy sexual thoughts and sexual feelings, they're really afraid that that is the portal to that, you know, that archetypal dark side, you know, that aggressive side.
Yes. Now, a closely related question that you raise is, how do they know when they're ready for sex again?
Oh, yeah, we talk about that a lot in the book. I have a couple of pages on that. And I borrowed this concept from Wendy Maltz. I want to give her credit for it, but she gave me permission to use this concept of hers. And I talk about the word certs as a representation of the five components of healthy sex, C-E-R-T-S. And those components are consent, equality, respect, trust, and safety. And she and I are on the same page with that if one of those variables is missing or is impaired in some way, then we don't have the conditions for healthy sexuality. So I talk a lot with my clients about healthy sexuality using that CERTS concept. There's also a lot of attention that we give to violence and intimate partner violence and abuse in relationships, too, whether it's verbal abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, because I do a lot of work with domestic violence, too. And we talk about how important it is that part of rape recovery includes participation in healthy relationships, nonviolent and equal relationships. So we talk about all of those things as part of healthy sexuality.
Do you find a link between rape and self-injury?
Yeah, a really big link. And the literature supports that, too. Some of the literature has found about an 80% correlation between sexual trauma and self-injury. And a lot of the women and men, I should, you know, it's late, but I need to mention that I work with male survivors, too. But I deal with a lot of self-injury, a lot of cutting, burning. I've even had women who, you know, bang their heads or hit themselves in frustration. So I do see a whole lot of self-injury stuff going on. And my challenge to take this delicate and potentially embarrassing part of their lives and show them the link, the connection that that has with their trauma. Because sometimes they don't even know that they're connected. They think of them as two different separate things.
Well, I'd like to get a little personal with you at this point. Has your heritage as a Native American impacted your approach to your work?
It really has. I'm an Ojibwe. My family is Canadian Ojibwe, and I still maintain some traditional points of view. You know, I'm teaching my boys some of the language, and we do participate in some of our traditional things. And the values of that upbringing do mean a lot. And some of our concepts that I bear with me are the idea of interconnection of life. And I'm not talking about anything new age here. I'm talking about the antidote for the rape victim's feeling of being uniquely disconnected and separated from all life and all relationship. I've even at times drawn upon some of my traditional things as part of healing and recovery with some of the women that I've worked with.
You pointed out that you're a 6 foot six guy, big guy.
Yeah.
How did you come to have this gentle side? What experience or person impacted you?
That's a good question. I got to give my parents a lot of credit. I have good parents. They actually moved from Canada to Alabama in the 60s to participate in the civil rights movement. So social justice has been in the forefront of just my upbringing.
Uh-huh.
My wife is my hero, and I'm not saying that to be corny, you know, to get points, but she's a moral rudder to me and teaches me a lot about insight and understanding intuition, and she's fiercely independent in her thinking and her philosophy. She doesn't drop her eyes or bow her head to anybody, and I like that. I feel then challenged. And it reminds me also that being a man in an equal relationship with a woman is a very healthy thing. And I like the idea of not only not being threatened by acknowledging somebody else's power, but realizing that acknowledging their power doesn't diminish my own. And so having those role models has really helped me. I didn't necessarily intend to make this my life's issue. But I can disclose to you, I can go ahead and divulge this, that my wife is a survivor. And that makes this a personal issue, and it puts me in a really, ironically, a good position to take this on, because it means I don't have the personal baggage of trauma that I have to filter through and worry about being triggered when I do this work. Yet it does mean that I'm passionate about it, and it is an issue that I care about for more than, you know, a paycheck or status or flattery of some type. So I would say that a lot of those things have really influenced me, plus being a dad of two boys. I have two little boys, and that really makes me consider the role of men in the world and what kind of men I want them to be and how we treat the people around us and how we connect with people. And you asked me about my Native heritage. One of the ways that my sons and I connect is we attend our sweat lodge ceremony nearly every week with other Native friends of mine. Are you familiar with what that is?
Yes, but feel free to say whatever you'd like to.
It's a really intense purification and cleansing ceremony using a combination of heat and water in what's considered to be probably the oldest Native or indigenous ceremony in this continent. And it's a way of psychologically purging out the things that are upsetting or troubling a person, leaving them in a place in the ceremony so that we can then depart from it cleansed again. And that helps me then stay connected with my family. It helps me with self-care because I hear a lot of rape trauma stories. And I don't want to become vicariously traumatized. I think self-care is necessary. I think therapists should have therapists. And part of my self-care is purging out a lot of those difficult emotions through ceremony and through cleansing ritual like that. And that's also the ceremony that I've provided to some of the people that I've worked with. When they have asked for it, I don't press it on them. and I don't want to bring them into an alien cultural experience and hope that it'll mean something if it won't. But for some people who have chosen that they want to participate in that, I've brought them. And they go through this incredible cleansing experience using intense heat and prayer and communion with one another. And it becomes life-changing. So I have at times brought those things into my work too, plus keeping myself balanced and healthy and positive as I do this work.
Well, I really appreciate your being open to sharing all of that personal information. It's very meaningful to me. It does raise one more issue to step back, which is, how does the man who's in relationship, the boyfriend, the husband, what can they do to be there for, to comfort their spouse, their girlfriend, the woman in their life who's been a victim?
Oh, let me just kind of plug something for a minute, because I've got a good answer to that. On my website, which is resurrectionafterrape.org, there's a section of bonus downloads, completely free. And in that section, there's a booklet that I wrote called A Man's Guide to Helping a Woman Who's Been Raped. There's another one called A Parent's Guide to Helping a Daughter Who's Been Raped.
Oh, wonderful.
You can download them for free. And a lot of women have downloaded them, and they've given them to parents who may have been frustrated, or, you know, aren't you over it yet, that kind of thing, or husbands that were getting frustrated. And what I thought, well, this might help a lot of men, but it turns out a lot of women have written to me and said, you know, reading this helped me. Because in these booklets, I'm explaining to men or to mom and dad why the survivor is doing certain things and feeling certain ways. And a lot of women said, I didn't even know why I was doing them until I read where you explained to other people why I was doing them. So it turns out it had more of a good effect than I realized. But you can get those for free. You know, I just want them to be available to anybody that can get helped by it.
Well, that's great to know. So I think we better wrap it up. Matt, I have really enjoyed talking to you, and hope that we get a chance to meet in person at some point.
Oh, that'd be great.
And I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
It's a good resource.
Okay. This felt to me like a particularly good interview, and it would be a useful one for you to refer anyone you know who has either suffered from rape or who works with rape victims. In addition, I would also recommend Matt's book very highly and his website, which once again can be found at www.resurrectionafterrape.org. I really do hope I get to meet Matt at some point. I'd feel especially privileged to be in one of his sweat lodges. Which brings to mind that he mentioned after the interview on our call that he started including some wilderness retreats in his work. I think you can find out more about these on his website as well. My conversation with Matt put me in mind of an earlier interview with Dr. Edgar Tick on Shrink Wrap Radio number 109, which was titled after his excellent book, War and the Soul. Both Matt and Ed Tick are dealing with the aftermath of trauma, and both approach healing in a very soulful way. I also recall that Dr. Tick draws heavily upon Native American rituals in his approach to post-traumatic healing with veterans.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.